We're excited to announce that our very own podcasting platform, Zencastr, has become a new sponsor to the show. Check out the podcast discount link in our show notes and stay tuned for why we love using Zen for the podcast.
You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is the CRM Archaeology Podcast. It's the show where we pull back the veil of cultural resources management archaeology and discuss the issues that everyone is concerned about. Welcome to the podcast. Hello and welcome to the CRM Archaeology Podcast, episode 214 for May 5th, 2021. I'm your host, Chris Webster. On today's show, Bill and I talk about reports in response to a listener comment on our members-only Slack team. So go to archpodnet.com/members to support us and join in the conversation because the CRM Archaeology Podcast starts right now. Welcome to the show, everyone. Joining me today is Bill in California.
Hello.
And we may have Heather joining us later. She's supposed to be on the show, but we had to punt our normal recording. So now we're like on a work day and she probably got called into a meeting because Heather is a very busy person at her company. So she will hopefully join us later. But in the meantime, Bill and I are going to press forward with this topic. Our topic today is essentially reports, right? Archaeology reports, CRM reports, and some of the things that go along with those. And what spawned this conversation was actually in a previous episode. It was mentioned, I don't even remember the context in which it was mentioned, but it was mentioned things like, you know, stuff that makes report writing a little bit faster and what we do. And I think I even said it, like you're usually like your historical context section. And when we say historical context, that's like prehistoric context, you know, what is the setting of the area, you know, that you're in? What is the setting that kind of is the basis for your research questions for that research design of that project? And a lot of times that's boilerplate. And boilerplate isn't necessarily a bad thing. It's just, this is how that is. You know what I mean? Like, it's archaeology. It doesn't change very often. If you're talking about the, you know, the paleo timeframes, like from 8,000 to say 14,000 years ago, there's very little that changes about that from year to year. You can probably get away with cutting and pasting that. You probably should do some research. I can remember one time. It was when the Paisley Caves article came out from Oregon, and I happened to be helping out or writing a section of a report or something for a company I worked with a long time ago. And I remember changing and updating our boilerplate for that company because of the Paisley Caves information. It gives us some additional information for that area, you know, for all of the Great Basin, basically, even though Paisley Caves is kind of like on the northern edge of it. And it really helped out, right? It was like additional information. I added it to the source material and I added it to our company boilerplate for the overall region and the area. And, you know, we've had some conversations come down the line. If you're not a member of the APN, go to archpodnet.com/members because we have a members only Slack team where our members can communicate with the hosts and we can have ongoing conversations about this, about any subject, right? Any subject you want to bring up. I mean, hopefully it's a podcast subject, but any subject really. And we've had a discussion about boilerplating. So that's where we're at. And Bill and I, we're not going to mention too many particulars about the actual conversation, but it did spark some ideas in us in how to talk about basically reports and how they work and putting these reports together. So that's kind of where we're at.
I read the comments too, and I can definitely see, you know, what the commenter was aiming for. And I fully agree. But the first thing I want to talk with that, because there's a couple of key pieces that in that conversation that cultural resources folks from coast to coast really need to start thinking about, especially like given the time that we're living in. So just in a nutshell, I've been doing some looking up information about cultural resources and the future of archaeology in the United States, because I'm concerned for students, I'm concerned for companies, I'm concerned for, you know, heritage sites and everything. You know, now my job is to help try to prepare students to go into archaeology, and CRM is pretty much the, you know, most steady game in town, for better or for worse. Mm-hmm. And so it's good for me to know what's going on in the industry so that I can help students better prepare. And I mean, there's kind of some big things that are coming. Like, first of all, because CRM was considered an essential service in the United States, it never shut down during COVID. And then right. we added on a whole bunch of stimulus measures, and there were a bunch of things that were given to governments to try and promote construction and a whole bunch of other stuff. We're trying to build more housing and everything. So that means that the CRM continued moving through the pandemic. And then we're looking at possibility of some more stimulus in the form of infrastructure improvements. And those of you who are still around during Obama, remember that that was kind of the only game in town when the recession really got deep and, you know, severe in 2008. It was those shovel ready projects that a lot of us were able to just keep doing our jobs, and CRM companies were able to stay alive during that. Right. So there's good outlook, good potential for people to have jobs in CRM. And that matters for students, because I also graduated from my undergrad and my master's in a time when it was before the Great Recession. So there was construction, and there was all the, you know, everything was running on full cylinders. And so there was jobs in CRM, right? But that's coming mm-hmm. into a time when we have fewer students, right? We lost a lot of students for COVID. And also universities are predicting that there's going to be a smaller and smaller number of students that are going to be coming through university departments, and anthropology departments specifically are running low on students. Fewer and fewer people are going into anthro departments. So why does this matter for me to talk about reports? We're going into a world where we're not going to be able to just pick and choose students as field techs. We're not going to be able to just pick and choose who we feel like or this or that. And they're not all going to have field schools, and they're not all going to be familiar with what CRM does. So one of the key things, and these are the folks who 20 years from now are going to be running CRM. So if they don't start off, it's just that same hurdle that every company has to retool every student. So it's important for students to understand what reports are. But I think a lot of people who are at the field tech, and even folks who are at the crew chief level, kind of don't even really understand what the report is. And it's really two things. It's us fulfilling our contractual obligations to provide our expert services to our clients, given what we know about historic preservation, archaeology, all that stuff, so that they can be in compliance with the law. But it's done in a format. The second thing is it's done in a format that's defined by the state. So each state has a reporting guideline. It tells us what has to be in our report, what we have to do to make sure that our report is going to pass the State Historic Preservation Office's review. And of course, you know, we're doing this work for the client as professionals, but it goes on to the State Historic Preservation Office. They're the ones who set up the framework. They're the ones who are also getting money through the Historic Preservation Fund and matching funds from the state to make sure that the state and its agencies and other government agencies are fulfilling their obligations under the law. So the report mm-hmm. is like, you know, the product, right? The product of the services. Like you could say maybe like a review of a court case is the, you know, product of both lawyers and the paralegals and everyone working on the case. That piece of paper, that decision, everything that's done there, that's their work. Well, CRM is kind of similar in that regard.
Yeah. And up here in Nevada, as an example, to illustrate what you're saying, the BLM has a specific outline that you have to follow for your reports. A lot of agencies do, really. And I think it's like 11 sections or 12 sections or something like that. I don't know. I really should look because I'm writing BLM reports right now. But I already have like my own templates that follow along with those. And as any business owner knows, the more systems and automations you can put in place for your business, from phone systems and email answering things and organizing tools and whatever you use for project management, the more tools like that you can put in your business, to be honest, the higher your profit margin, right? Because you lower your overhead expenses and you, to be blunt about it, you make more money. That's the other thing. We have to talk about money because CRM, you know, we all got into archaeology because we have a passion for archaeology and history. And we might think, oh, earning money is dirty and bad. And sure, go ahead and think that. But that's not how companies operate in a business world. So you have to stay profitable in order to have a job. And you can't, I mean, sure, you can run a nonprofit, but nonprofit doesn't mean you're making negative money every month, right? Nonprofit just means you're taking all your mm-hmm. profits and you're doing something with them that's company related, right? You're still paying salaries. You're still, you know, paying the overhead. You still have office space. You still have trucks. You still have all those things. So any place where you can reduce your cost, you're going to do that if you want to stay in business and you want to keep doing archaeology. Boilerplating certain things, while may seem unethical to some people, is is a really efficient way to get some of those sections of the report done. And I don't think there's anybody that doesn't read the boilerplate and think, man, I read an article in the Archaeological Record or Journal of California Archaeology or something that contradicts something over here, or maybe adds to it, or is, you know, something like that. Or we did a project last year that was in the same area. Let me take a look at that. And then we update the boilerplate. So I think as archaeologists, we're pretty good about looking at those things, you know, and in fact, we're pretty bad at managing budgets. So we honestly do spend way more time on that kind of stuff than we probably should. But, you know, there it is. But there's a reason for that. Boilerplate is a tool that we use to save us time. And that means we can do more of what we're out there to be doing. So and honestly, that comes down to what's the purpose of a report too, which I'm sure we're going to spend a lot of time on. But I mean, to be blunt about it, the purpose of a report is to collect and write up the results of your survey so they can be actioned on by another agency. They can decide what to do, you know, or the client can decide what mm-hmm. to do. It's not really our job to make this monumental, you know, discovery and publish, you know, this book about it. Those are all extra things. If you have time and you can do that, sure, you can write papers, you can go to conferences and present, you can write a book, you can go get a PhD, but it's not going to have anything to do with the budget for that project. Nothing.
I think the PhD is how we got in trouble in the first place.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the boilerplate thing, I think the person who was responding in the discussion, which, you know, I hope folks engage in these discussions. This is how we move forward. I mean, these are the kind of things that we should be talking about, places like the podcast and the members only, as you know, where we get to actually talk about this kind of stuff when we don't mm-hmm. have to be in the same place, right? It's hard for us all to be in the same room together. So it's cool that we work through all this kind of stuff, because this didn't really exist before we were on social media and all this stuff, you know, 10, 15 years ago. But I think the person who commented, like, the big thing that they were most concerned with is that these boilerplate chunks are not made in consultation or collaboration with, you know, tribes. Yeah. I would definitely say we'd need to be working with tribes, but, you know, I'd even expand that to actually people who live in certain cities and districts and stuff, right? Because we're missing out on a huge opportunity to collect information from folks who live in these communities. And I know there's some folks who would just be saying, well, we don't have the time or budget for that. We don't have any kind of money that we can afford to spend on that. Well, in the background, while you're talking, I looked up the state of California's fieldwork and reporting guidelines, and I looked mm-hmm. through there, and there are several different locations where they specifically say they have big sections that talk specifically about consultation with Native American folks. And there's state bills at the state level in California where, you know, you have to consult with tribes. As we were talking before we started to record, though, that consultation thing is weighed in you get a huge range of latitude. You know, consultation could be me basically sending some kind of threat letter to someone saying, you know, this Circle K is going in on this block and I don't care unless you respond in 48 hours and tell me all your cultural secrets. Like, we're doing this project any which way, right? And I mean, in other places where I've worked, that is kind of what they consider consultation. We're going to build townhomes right here on this shell mound. If you would say something now or forever hold your peace, right? So, you know, that's one form of consultation. But nowhere in this is the mention of the word collaboration, not even between government agencies, not between CRM companies, not even between archaeologists at the same company. They don't even say you have to collaborate with your PI or field techs to do the work. It just says consultation. And I think that's the thing that the boilerplate misses. And that's the one piece that I think, more than us reading yet another history book on the French and Indian War or something like that, we need to be out there talking to people who are the descendants of that, you know, not mm-hmm. just, I mean, first and foremost, connect with indigenous people, right? Because those voices are the ones that have been silenced the most. And once you've, you know, started there, then start talking to other people who can trace back several generations of being in this area, right? So you're getting a more holistic view that's not just, you know, so-and-so's accounts from 1913 of the Pike County elders who were all passing away from the War of 1812, their memories from their grandkids. You know what I'm saying? Like, we all cite these old history books from these old days, but we never cite talking to a Native American elder or talking to a tribal historic preservation office. That's very rarely put in the report.
Yeah. And I totally agree with you. I think that in a perfect world, we would all just include that as part of our methodology, right? You win this proposal, you start making preparations for your field work. In those preparations, you do a literature search at the appropriate places where, you know, documents could be stored, site records, things like that, reports for the project that you're working in. And then you summarize that information. Some people call it like a phase 1A kind of thing, the literature search report. You might not be formalizing it, but you should be internally collecting those sources and organizing them and reading through them and seeing what you have. And then you consult with the tribes that have jurisdiction over that area. Some of them may say, yeah, we got nothing, right? And that's okay. And some may have a lot of information for you. We don't even consult with our other colleagues that have worked in that area generally, right? Somebody may have done a report that you pulled in your literature search. They may have surveyed exactly right next to where you're going to be surveyed 3 years ago, but they're from another company. Are we going to call the people that did that report and say, hey, you guys got any good information for us? I mean, that just doesn't happen. So we got to get better at that.
Yeah. And I'd add to that, in the perfect world, because this is the most perfect world we're ever going to live in. It would be great if archaeologists just it's all uphill, right? It's all uphill. If you talk to your grandparents, it was uphill both ways in the snow. So yeah, we're in this place and it's going to be all uphill both ways in the desert.
Nice.
I would say that the biggest thing would be that archaeologists are humble enough to acknowledge that the stuff that they're working on is not their own ancestral stuff. And to, before they're even going into this thing, start trying to be, just as someone who is interested in history and interested in cultures, offer your services and reach out to people, whether they ask for it or not, because you know that later on, yeah, you know, that Lithuanian immigrant community or this Italian American or this tribe or whatever is going to someday see one of their heritage sites in front of the bulldozer, and they're going to want to know what they could possibly do about it. And at that point, you will have offered, you will be out there. So rather than just spending all your time learning about arrowheads or ceramics or whatever archaeologists do, try to be a real citizen and recognize that what you're doing has huge impacts for communities. And by not being in the world, the community where you already live, and knowing the different groups that are in that community, I mean, you're basically putting yourself in a situation where you open yourself up for, you know, I wouldn't say litigation as much as just, it makes you look like you know less. I mean, if you talk to indigenous people and you talk about this whole archaeology direction or whatever, and you say you have a PhD, they're just going to laugh at you and be like, well, I mean, I've been here for 12,000 years. So what would you possibly know? That's kind of humbling to recognize that you've spent, you know, 20 something years on this thing and five figures on a degree in something that these folks were born and know from the very beginning. However, you never one time even thought to talk to them about it.
That's a good point. All right. And I think with that, it's a good stopping point. Let's take a break and come back on the other side of this. And I want to bring up some stuff about maybe where we could go, because I always like to see where the big picture is if we had a blank check. Back in a minute.
Downhill in the desert. Downhill.
Chris Webster here for the Archaeology Podcast Network. We strive for high quality interviews and content so you can find information on any topic in archaeology from around the world. One way we do that is by recording interviews with our hosts and guests located in many parts of the world all at once. We do that through the use of Zencastr. That's Zencastr. Zencastr allows us to record high quality audio with no stress on the guest. Just send them a link to click on and that's it. Zencastr does the rest. They even do automatic transcriptions. Check out the link in the show notes for 30% off your first 3 months, or go to zencastr.com and use the code CRMARC. Looking to expand your knowledge of x-rays and imaging in the archaeology field? Then check out An Introduction to Paleoradiography, a short online course offering professional training for archaeologists and affiliated disciplines. Created by archaeologist, radiographer, and lecturer James Elliott, the content of this course is based upon his research and teaching experience in higher education. It is approved by the Chartered Institute for Archaeologists as 4 hours of training. That's in the UK, for those of you that don't know. So don't miss out on this exciting opportunity for professional and personal development. For more information on pricing and course structure, visit paleoimaging.com. That's paleoimaging.com. And look for the link in the show notes to this episode.
Welcome back to episode 214 of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. My God, 214 episodes. Let's just pause on that one for a second. A lot. Anyway, let's talk about big picture here, because we all know that there are, I don't know, problems, issues, things that we deal with current practices. And it's really nobody's fault, to be honest. It's just, it's part of a system that is not cohesively managed across many agencies, many firms, many people, many states for that matter. Everybody kind of does their own thing, comes up with their own thing. And because of that, you end up with this mishmash of policies and, you know, what have you. But I like to think, just in case some agency people happen to be listening that have some sort of influence here, I like to think, what would be the best practices for, let's just say, historical context, boilerplated historical context. And I'll give mine first. I feel like the agency, obviously, should be the lead caretaker of these, only because they are the single point where all of us are sending our reports, right? So if you look at Nevada, BLM Nevada gets almost everything that's done in the state, right? Because, like, I don't know, something like 80% to 90% of all the land in Nevada is managed by the BLM. So they get almost everything. These are locked away in file cabinets, put on their servers. Information is kept right there. Now, I understand, again, budgets are tight. I'm not talking about how to pay for this. You know, we never talk about that. This is how would things run in an optimal situation. So to me, it seems like that historical context section, it's for some reports, it's really big. For some reports, it's smaller. It depends on the types of things that were found in your area and what's in your area, right? Like if you only found historic things, you don't really need a prehistoric context over there because it's not going to come up. You didn't find anything, right? So in some cases, maybe that adds to the prehistoric context, the fact that you didn't find anything. So you got to kind of take a look at that. It's our job to look at that historic context and say, can I add or remove anything from this? And in a perfect world, I would love to pull down that boilerplate before I go out in the field, read the historical context, figure out how to, you know, set up my research questions and say, okay, so based on this and some other research we've done, I think that, you know, we have a good chance of answering these questions, right? We can add some data to these questions. And then if you do, great. You resubmit your report in a separate interface. You submit your historical context and you say, I'm updating paragraphs 2, 3, and 4 of context, you know, 1.5, 3.2, and 4.1. And, you know, they're cataloged and it's almost like a wiki, right? It's something that all of us can have access to. The public should have access to it, right? I mean, maybe only quote unquote qualified people should have access to update it. Maybe that's the BLM. I don't know. Maybe that's BLM permitted archaeologists. Again, I don't know. But if we had all the access to read it and then had a way to make changes, vote on those changes, because maybe you found something that was unique and you have to wait for other people to find stuff before a number of people can agree with you on that. And then you can make that change to the, you know, to the historical context wiki. But it really should be crowdsourced from all the sources, because again, a lot of companies just work in a silo, right? They have their own reports. They have their own history of that area, especially the ones that have been working for, you know, decades in a single area. And there's lots of those. They have really good background of what they've done, right? But how often are they updating their own historical context, first off? And how often do other people read those that are new to the area, even though they have access to those reports? How often do they read them and update their own historical context? And then, you know, what do they do? Where do they get them? How does that work? I mean, it should be crowdsourced. Yeah. That's my thought.
Well, I mean, I totally agree with the update thing. And I found myself updating them a lot because I hear what you're saying. Like if you're in a place where you're more likely to find the historical stuff, specifically if you can see the building standing right there, those are going to have to be evaluated. You might put more weight on that. Just like you were saying, we have to evaluate how much time we have to dedicate to each piece. But I found myself, as a historical archaeologist, updating historical contexts like every single project, because even at companies that had multiple branches and had worked in that county for, you know, the last 20 something years, you could pretty much tell that the person who had done it had gone through every minute detail of every pit feature and every form of agave, you know, agricultural thing on their PhD, but they hadn't spent any time to the massive multi-field ranch with a dairy barn and all the other stuff that was like right in the middle of the project area. And so they would just kind of say, right, you know, in 1942, there was dairying, as figure 5 shows, there was a dairy farm. And so that was kind of like all that was ever given to that entire section. And, you know, you're going to have to, you know, evaluate all those roads and fence lines and every single thing associated with the historical period that no one had ever spent any time doing. So I found myself updating those all the time. And I also worked for a couple of companies that had kind of a very specific way that they wrote. You know, I even worked for one where in the off time when you weren't actively working on a project, if you had a specialty, like if you had a skill in groundstone or experience with certain kinds of ceramics, you would spend times building like what they would call modules. And so there would be modules on groundstone from whatever time period that's associated with like agave harvesting, or groundstone that's associated with mesquite processing. And, you know, you'd write two or three pages and they would regularly update that based on new dissertations and new stuff that had been done. And then like, if you came across those agricultural fields, you could go to the folder and find the agave thing and talk about the way that that was practiced in that part of Arizona. Or you could go to the railroads thing, and people had written reports where certain different railroads had historical context that they'd written. And so all those things were kind of stored on like a server at the company level, where if you had one of those kind of resources, you could go and find that thing. And then everything was supposed to be written from general to specific, right? So you would start at like kind of the county level or the regional level, and you would move throughout time down to that specific township and range where that activity was actually taking place. So like by writing in that kind of modular way, it was really easy at these companies for you to get a lot of information and to get those different bricks to put together your thing and then adjust your report after you discovered things, right? So let's say we thought we were going to find all these ranching things. We never found any of the ranching stuff, but we found things that are associated with these other kind of like pathways or game trails or other things that are part of, you know, memory or other played a role in history. So then maybe we would talk about those kind of like pedestrian trails or, you know, cattle drive routes or something like that. So like those, I was always updating the historical context. And I know I worked for companies where they were always updating the prehistoric context, especially with ceramics in Arizona. I mean, there was some folks who had done like their entire dissertation on ceramics. The archaic was like a super popular thing that a lot of the paleo folks had switched over to archaic, since you never find any paleo sites. But then all of a sudden they were discovering archaic. So a lot of people were writing on the archaic, and we were learning a lot of stuff in Arizona on that. And so I'm just wondering, like, how static is the boilerplate at every company? Like, are companies actually giving people the chance to use their brains that they hired them to have? And if so, I mean, kind of, what you're talking about having this wiki would be more like sharing these resources that are already part of these public reports that are going to be published that already exist at companies. So maybe just even like once you've had your credentials vetted, or they know that you're not just like an ancient aliens, you know, fringe person, you can have access to the Google Drive that's already gigabytes of quality stuff written by PhDs all over the place. But the problem with that is, then are you plagiarizing other companies? Because I was always told that you're never supposed to take another company's report and then just cut and paste their thing and put it in your report. That was actually, in fact, like, for whatever reason, you couldn't self-plagiarize yourself in your own company, because that was proprietary knowledge that company had created. But you could plagiarize someone else's report by taking and cutting and pasting their thing and putting it in. So the wiki thing, would that mean that you still have to remodel and rewrite it? Like, you just get to see all the stuff that they know and then you can rewrite yours better? Or are you talking about just straight up sharing boilerplate like across entire regions?
Here, this is the messed up thing about our profession, right? And the messed up thing about CRM. The historical context shouldn't be owned by anyone. Like, I don't care who wrote it. It's not owned. It's learned information about the history of an area, the historical or prehistorical history of an area. A company shouldn't be able to own the historical context. Sure, they own everything else in the report, but how can they own the historical context?
Well, because they wrote it, just like, you know, you have the ownership of your master's thesis because you have the copyright of it because you wrote it. I know it was based on stuff that many could have had access to, like artifacts and other stuff, but like, they're the ones who made it. They're the ones who paid the people to get it. Like, right. I mean, I'm for sharing this like background, you know, stuff, or even the systems. Like, I hope the people that are out there listening to me are not just in a situation where they're like going to the last report we did in that county from like 94 and then just cut and pasting that Word document and just trying to augment that thing. Like, the idea is to have these different files on the server so that you're, you know, professionals in geomorphology can be telling you stuff, or your historical archaeologist, or your, you know, architectural historian can be putting these things on the, like, bricks that then you just go through and pull them out. So I'm cool with sharing the bricks, but I'm definitely not cool with, like, you know, everybody just taking the same report. Because also the other thing is, imagine if you were from that community and they're going to put in like a pipeline or something. They've atomized it into 42 different segments. And all 42 of the reports have the same exact verbiage at all for, you know, the previous 7,000 years of history. And then there's like one paragraph of difference at the end. And then the results of the survey, like, you're not really learning anything about your area.
Okay. So you're right. That does seem ridiculous. However, I think when I was talking like about a historical context, like wiki type of thing, it really was born out of a discussion that we had a couple podcasts ago. And I can't remember if you were on that one, Bill, but I know Heather and I were for sure on there talking about reports of the future. Right. Because you're right. If you've got this pipeline segmented into 42 different things, you've got 42 different companies working on it, it would be absolutely ridiculous for each 300 page report to only have 5 pages that were different. That would be totally ridiculous. Yeah, right?
No joke. I mean, well, in every single one of them, they're charging anywhere from like $58,000 to like $700,000. And the only thing they did was 5 pages.
Exactly. My point exactly. But what we should do is, if we're going to really blue sky this thing, is we should figure out how to better write reports. First off, we shouldn't be doing reports in the segmented sections like we are now in paper and, you know, on a CD drive and sent to the BLM and then, you know, 3 different copies, 2 bound, 1 unbound. That is total BS these days. The reason we have the whole concept of boilerplate is because we are putting together these types of archaic reports, right? And I don't mean archaic in the good sense. I mean archaic in the bad sense, because a report about the archaic would be fascinating. However, what I mean is, really, we need to rethink how these reports are done, because each one of those 42 different reports for that pipeline, I'm imagining it more as an online resource. Like, you go to the GIS for that, you know, whatever the thing is, like Washington has Wizard and, you know, NevCris in Nevada and the Chris in California. You go to the GIS, you click on segment number 1, and the how-to section, what do they call that? The methods section is right there. You click on that, bam, and a web page opens with their methods section. You click on their analysis or their results, bam, you see the results. All the site records are listed right there. You can go to each one of those site records and see those as well. You go to the historical context. Okay, so they used context 5, 6, 9, and 14 from the historical context wiki. Bam, I can pull those into, and now I can read those and find out, you know, what the history of that area is. So it's a whole different way of thinking about reports. And I don't think it's plagiarizing either, because again, I feel like we're all adding to the archaeological record. Every time we do a report, every time we do a project, we're all adding one more tiny little slice of the pie. But who owns the pie, right? We all own the pie. And if you are working in an area and you want to start from a standpoint of somebody else's historical context, it shouldn't be somebody else's. It should be a common resource that we pull from. If we can add to it, great. If we can't add to it, we cite where we got it. This is the, you know, this is the BLM Northeast Region historical context for sector 5 mm-hmm. of township and range, you know, whatever, right? This is where this came from. It's not plagiarism. Mm-hmm. It's the truth of that area based on everyone's decades of research. And it's a collaborative document.
Sure.
That's a pie in the sky sort of attitude, I know, but.
Well, but I mean, they did that in the 80s, though. They had those resource review. I mean, in the state of Washington, when I was working there, they had, like, you had to always go to the R3, which was like resource reference or something or other. And they were like historic context, basically. Like, I mean, we have them now too, like thematic context or historical context on like work camps in California or roads or something like that. I've seen them on dumps or something in Arizona. They have them on informal landfills and other kinds of stuff like mm-hmm. that. And they had them in Washington on these different tribal areas and stuff. And so it seemed like, you know, those were kind of, I mean, in my own experience, I remember those historic contexts being awesome resources to get going, right? Like, we've got this roadside dump. It's full of all kinds of garbage over the last 70 years. You know, does it actually meet the requirements, the Secretary of Interior? You know, what can it actually tell? I mean, those, they always gave me a good way to go with these kind of resources that were commonly encountered, right? But yeah. I, you know, I don't know if there was ever really any kind of like collaboration. They were kind of created by the State Historic Preservation Office as like, you know, if you come across the road, this is the history that you're supposed to know. But of course, you know, we're trying to give advice on National Historic Preservation Act. So of course we have to add in the other thing that makes that one road particularly not eligible or eligible. And that's like difficult to have in kind of a warehouse thing that you're talking about. I mean, I'm totally for sharing information and definitely having like work groups at the state level too. I'm a member of a couple of these really cool groups that have kind of come out since COVID of meeting on Zoom and talking about resources in different parts of states. And like, you know, there are along certain kinds of things that we're interested in. It's really cool.
Yeah.
But we don't really have like a bibliography or a, like a Google Drive of our stuff. Maybe that could be a thing that folks who are interested, right? They kind of form these work groups.
All right. Well, that's a good point for our next break. Let's come back on the other side and solve all the problems for these guys that are listening so they can just take what we're saying and incorporate it into their state's historical information systems. So good.
Just cut and paste the podcast and put it right into your report.
Boilerplate this podcast straight in. Back in a minute. You may have heard my pitch for membership. It's a great idea and really helps out. However, you can also support us by picking up a fun t-shirt, sticker, or something from a large selection of items from our Tee Public store. Head over to arcpodnet.com/shop for a link. That's arcpodnet.com/shop to pick up some fun swag and support the show. All right. Welcome back to episode 214 of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. And we are talking about reports, best practices. And Bill, I'm interested to hear your pie in the sky take like 20 years from now, 30 years from now. I hope it's not that long, but how we're doing reports. But I want to say before you get to that, you know, when you're talking about like building these blocks or modules from different sources and building your own thing, right? It really made me think about kind of fleshing out my idea that I mentioned about having, you know, your report be basically all on the internet, like things are these days, but in some sort of, you know, obviously behind a wall sort of database where you're pulling from different sections, you click on it. It's no longer a, like a paper report that you have to go to a file cabinet and find. And even if it's the CD in there, that should not be a thing in 2021, but you've got your different sections and you can see a comparison of the sections you wrote in that area versus sections other people wrote in that area. You could see like a side-by-side thing and then see them almost as blocks, like you said, and you pull this block, this block, this block, this block. And before you even start your project, you've got like 80% of what your report is going to be. And you go in and make your modifications and changes and you upload your modifications and changes to the system once you're done. But you basically start to build your report and doing your literature search, because we all do lit searches too, right? How about just pulling down a literature search that's already been done, if one was done just a year ago, and then say to the system, were there any other things added between that time and this time? Give me those as well. That shouldn't be, it's not rocket science, right? It's just searching. But we don't have the databases and the information to be able to do that. So I would really like to get to a point where all that is possible. But of course, the biggest problem with all this and all of the digital systems that we do have, there's probably people listening right now that work in, you know, SHPOs or places where they've got these things. There is such a backlog of getting the historical data input because that was not collected digitally. That stuff has got to be gone through, not just scanned, but if you want to do it right, it's got to be scanned, OCR'd, the text brought in, verified, changed. I mean, it is a project that no one has the budget for. So I totally fully understand that. But going forward, at least we could get on the right track, you know? So what's your pie in the sky attitude towards reports? Yeah.
So first of all, like, you know, being a realist, like you just said, right? I mean, we all have these ideas, but we're in a system where even the software is old. Yeah. And it's, I mean, I, of course, this is a side note that takes us nowhere near archaeology, but I just ended up watching the documentary, The Last Blockbuster. And I guess there's one Blockbuster video that's still alive in Bend, Oregon. And there's the manager of that store has to kind of do a Han Solo Chewbacca pirate off of these older computers to even just, you know, maintain the database of the videos that they use for the software. And I can totally imagine there are states out there that are totally doing that, where they're using these ancient, you know, Windows 93 softwares to try and somehow survive and keeping one computer alive that can still run a hard disk or a floppy disk so that they can download info. It's like, I can absolutely see that going on somewhere in the United States. So I gotta, you know, be a bit more pragmatic, but you know, the one thing that I'd like to see is, of course, I still think that all the reports need to be printed off in paper, because you never know what the hell is going to happen. I mean, I know that even paper can go up in flames too, but yeah, you know, we'll print off one that's still pretty good and keep it at the repository and maybe keep them at university libraries or something else where, you know, folks can see things that are not necessarily too controversial, confidential, that we're not giving away site locations and stuff. But the one thing that I'd like to see is making a vernacular version and making that thing available as a downloadable PDF at the State Historic Preservation Office website or the county or your own company, that you redact the once the project's done and you don't have to worry about giving up site locations or something like that, or redact actual site locations. But give folks that history and that background, especially if they did the piece that I was talking about where they talked to communities. And you know, it seems like that was a pie in the sky thing. But I've been on projects where we had historians and they interviewed, you know, Japanese American or African American people. And we put that in the report. I mean, those are things that happen. It's not just only forced consultation or even just, you know, by law consultation. It's actual people doing good quality CRM work and talking to human beings and putting that in the report. I mean, the audio files from that, those are also transcribed and those are given as data that are also given to the repository. So, you know, if you did do that, if you went to the neighborhoods, you talked with elders, you put that in there, you even had photos of the place where the thing was at that don't give away site locations, and you've got these historical photos and you put together this totally awesome thing. I'm talking about more for like phase two or data recovery projects. I mean, we write these huge reports for these data recovery projects, and then our own students can't even actually get it to see it that are at universities in that county, right? Because they're all hidden away somewhere where no one can ever see it. Well, redact those site locations and put the same PDF out for free for people to download, because the state's already paid for it. Your clients have already paid for it. Once the project's done, you know, you're not going to get sued necessarily. So make sure all the sensitive stuff's taken out and give people that history and those memories so that they can get it. Like, that's the one thing that I'd like to see. Mm-hmm. That we start writing our reports so that they have a vernacular version, that it would be easy to take away these site locations and sensitive photos and just let people see what we've put together.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the name of the game, right? Like, people don't see enough of what we do, right?
No, they don't.
Yeah. You know, one thing that I'm reminded of with this conversation, and I'm trying to remember right now what the heck it's called because it's brand new and I'm hoping it comes to me, but I'm in a lot of podcasting circles, right? I get emails from different newsletters from people who are in the podcasting industry, and I'm on podcast editor groups and podcast, you know, all this podcast stuff, right? Totally different world from archaeology. And one of the new things that's, I don't want to say hitting the world by storm here, but it kind of is a little bit, but it's an automatic show notes writer and blog post writer, to be honest. And it's basically, you answer like these wizard type questions and you say, what are you looking for right here? Are you looking for, you know, a couple paragraphs of show notes? Are you looking for a 1,000-word blog post? What are you looking for? So you give it the structure. Then you start entering a few keywords in. And then based on your keywords, it starts suggesting different, you know, like every paragraph has like a thesis statement. It basically has like a suggested thesis statements based on that. And it's pulling all this information from everywhere on the internet, right? It's basically doing a detailed Google search of everything that's already available. And then you start picking and choosing little things, but you essentially whittle it down to where this machine learning computer system has basically constructed a human readable, unique, it's not plagiarized, a human readable, unique piece of text, whether it's a couple paragraphs or 1,000 words or, you know, 10,000 words, it doesn't matter. But it's constructed this logical, constructed thing based on the choices that you made. Now, question for you, Bill. Obviously, we couldn't use this to write our reports because the information that we're looking for is not freely accessible on the internet. That's what this thing relies on. It relies on already published sources, so you don't basically have to do any research, right? I mean, that's essentially what it's doing. So regardless of what you feel about that, I'm interested in the technology, because if we could apply that to multi-state databases like the DINA index, like the Digital Index of North American Archaeology. Uh-huh. What is it? Yeah, North American Archaeology. So Dina.
Yeah, North American Archaeology.
Yeah, they have like, last I looked, it's like 20 states or something like that are coming under their umbrella with information. If we could pump this thing, take this logic and put it onto a structure like that and say, okay, I did a project in Mississippi. It was in this county, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and then have it just write the report for you. You know, here's where our methods were. You upload some other information. Obviously, it's not going to have any, you know, some of your stuff based on like site record data or shovel testing data or whatever, but maybe it could. How do you feel about something like that? I mean, it would be unique. It would be not plagiarized, but it's pulling from other sources in a more automatic way than what we were mentioning earlier as like the blocks of information. And then you're basically rewriting that or doing something like that. How do you feel about something like that kind of technology?
Yeah, I mean, it makes me feel pretty uncomfortable.
I figured it would.
But, you know, just at the end of the day, then that means that basically folks are just going out there and walking around and then just saying that there's stuff out there and you just click a button or two and it generates a report, right? It's similar to these like record searches that get paid that are outsourced to magical God knows where. And so then you'll see these like cell tower things. And it's like, you know, this cell tower will go on the historic National Cathedral in Washington, D.C. There's no historic sites anywhere near it. You know, like there's one schoolhouse. And you know that it's just straight up people like Googling like historical near cathedral and then putting in the address. And then hopefully Google gives them the stuff. So I can definitely see exactly where that's going to happen, where, you know, people just walk around. They don't know how to identify resources. They don't know what a historic building even looks like. And they're just with their head down looking for matates on the ground and they miss like every single thing. And then you click, you know, report, generate report, right? So I think that there's going to be a bunch of like engineering-ish kind of, you know, solutions, environmental firms that will totally glom onto this thing. Whereas the quality archaeology is still going to happen. Like people are still going to have to use their minds and they're still going to have to write reports. And, you know, they're going to be better off for our own knowledge and applying those things. And just being good at what we do better than, you know, a machine. If a machine could find artifacts, then why do we even need archaeologists? Well, because a machine can't find artifacts. So it's the same thing with a report. If a software could write a report, then we wouldn't need archaeologists, except a software can't really write a report. It's going to give you an auto-tuned generic thing that's not, you know, like I said, it's going to pass the muster in places where they want it to pass the muster. But the thing that totally I got intrigued about was, you know how when you do your record search and you look for the polygons of like previous surveys and like where their survey areas were at, and then it'll show you the sites that are in there, right? And so usually what you get on your record search is this GIS layer that's all the different polygons that are pretty much from like 2003 or whenever they started doing that on, right? So over the last 20 years, all the different surveys, here's the area they've surveyed. And then you get another map that shows like where all the sites that anyone's ever found is at. Well, what I was just thinking is that data right there, if you could get that, then essentially you can have a composite of which companies ever find anything and like how big of areas have already been surveyed and like how many times have they been surveyed and by whom and which archaeologists find stuff, right? You know what I'm saying? Like, do they ever see Chris Webster and Bill White's names on sites? Or is it always like Chris and Bill are out there and they surveyed like most of this entire county. However, they have never found a single thing, because then that would tell you like where the deficiency are in their education. Like, you know, Chris and Bill have found a million Native American sites, but they've never found a historical period one ever, including this one that goes across of like half of this town, right? Like they walked an entire transmission corridor through 55, you know, farms that have been around for 70 years and never found a historical thing the whole way, but they found 22 different prehistoric or places where they want to develop for logging or something like that, where none of the companies magically ever find a site, whereas like one township over companies find tons of sites on that same slope and angle and all that different stuff, right? Like that's the thing that was like, huh, that'd be sweet if, you know, like if we could just start getting into that of, you know, which companies ever find anything. Crazy, I used to work in Tucson. There was one company that like in downtown Tucson in the most archaeologically sensitive zone had done over 50% of all the CRM work. Jeez. Since like 1980, 85 or whatever. But before like 2005 or something like that, they had done like 80% of all the work in the city. And it was one company that was getting like all the work, that had written all the reports and had found all the sites and all the different stuff. And it was kind of like, now how did that happen? And then you look and see like, they went to the local university and they had people at the State Historic Preservation Office and they had folks on all these different things. And it's kind of like, huh, so they're really active in archaeology and they've gotten almost all the contracts in this entire town that's loaded with historical stuff. Like, it'd be interesting to see if that's the way it is in like Des Moines or Seattle or something like that. Are there companies that are doing all the work? And also, are there companies in like whatever town that do tons of work but never find anything? I mean, that's a long rant, but I don't think we should ever auto-tune our reports. I can tell you that. We can work together and share results and stuff, but just clicking the button, I'm telling you, like, you've seen those, you know what I'm talking about. You see the reports, it's a cell tower and it's literally like 90 something pages with four photos. And you can tell it's just a series of tables, a couple of photos. They say they didn't find anything. And you can see like an old historical farm in the background. Nope, there's nothing there right there. Like, that building with Zillow tells you it was built in 1938. You didn't find anything. I can see it in your photo. Nope, no history there.
Right. Yeah, you're supposed to take for the form 622s, I think it is, or 621s for the FCC. You're supposed to take north, at the very least, photos from the tower facing north, south, east, west, and photos to the tower facing north, south, east, west. So you're going to see something. You better do your research. But again, like you said, nobody's paying attention and nobody wants to point out, oh, wait a minute, there's actually something historical there. You know, nobody at the client level is going to point that out. They don't want to know that. So yeah. And I'll tell you what, the whole thought of coming up with like a site to acreage ratio for companies, like, you surveyed 2 million acres last year and you found four sites and also getting a little better quality statement too. Like, you found, you surveyed 1 million acres and you found 1,000 sites and one of them was historic. Like, Bill, is it a problem that DigTech has never recorded a historic road? I'm just asking for a friend. Is that I'm kidding though.
But I was going to say, your biggest problem is that when you were driving around that historic wagon broken down that said Oregon or bust, and you just drove around it but didn't record the road as like a historic site, like, that's the problem. That was
right,
the problem.
Right. Like, I don't record wagons, but this road, damn it, this road is historic. That's hilarious. Yeah, I could imagine if that number ever got out too, like, if somebody came up with that in an agency database, and then that number got out and clients were able to see that, they would shift to the proposals of the clients with like the worst ratio, right? Like, these guys never find anything. Let's hire them.
Oh yeah. I mean, like, if you're a tribe or a historic preservation organization, you want to find the very best that find stuff, right? But if you're like a developer, you want another golf course to come in or this canal to go down, like, yeah, you know, you want to find those ringers that never find anything.
You know, on the other hand, the more savvy developers that do this all the time, they also don't want to lose their permits and get sued. So they may use the number for a better reason, to find somebody, you know, more in the middle, that's going to not cause a lawsuit to happen in their name. You know what I mean? So anyway.
Yeah, I hear you. Well, I say no auto-tune reports. No, we're not going to click the algorithm. I'm not doing it. I'm still going to keep teaching people how to do technical writing, and I'm still going to keep doing it myself. So,
Bill,
I don't know what to say.
You may as well quit Berkeley right now, because I'm going to get a drone to do your survey, and I'm going to auto-tune your reports. So there you go.
Well, if the drone is like R2-D2, I'm down. If it's like C-3PO, I'm out of here. No.
Nice. All right. Well, that's it. This has been awesome. I wish Heather could have joined us, because she was really the one chiming in on this. But hey, head over to arcpodnet.com/members. Remember, read the stuff on that page, see what you get before you click in and decide to become a member. Don't ever go to the APN page and click the login button at the bottom corner unless you already have a membership, because it's not going to tell you what's provided. That's just how the system is that we decided to use. I don't know why they do this, but you already have to know what plan you want. So go to the arcpodnet.com/members first. Read about the membership plan. There's only one. You can get it up by the month or annually. It's cheaper if you do it annually. And then support us in all the things we do. And then once you do that, I'll add you to the Slack team and you can join in this conversation. Talk to us. If we can get Bill to sign up over there, you can talk to him too, and he can chime in on these things.
I did sign up.
Good.
I signed up.
Good. So, all right, everybody, thanks a lot, and we'll see you next time.
That's it for another episode of the CRM Archaeology Podcast. Links to some of the items mentioned on the show are in the show notes for this podcast, which can be found at www.arcpodnet.com/CRM Arc Podcast. Please comment and share anywhere you see the show. If you'd like us to answer a question on a future episode, email us. Use the contact form on the website, or just email chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Support the show and the network at arcpodnet.com/members. Get some swag and extra content while you're there. Send us show suggestions and interview suggestions. We want this to be a resource for field technicians everywhere, and we want to know what you want to know about.
Thanks to everyone for joining me this week. Thanks also to the listeners for tuning in, and we'll see you in the field. Goodbye.
See you later.
This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV Traveling America, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.